From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On October 13th, The Washington Times reported an American soldier based in Iraq as saying, "If one person dies, five or six are getting wounded, but people are only hearing about the one who was killed." In fact, as of October 30th, the total number of American soldiers wounded since the war began has reached 2,084. That's 1,745 wounded in hostile combat and 339 in non-hostile action. New Republic senior editor Lawrence Kaplan recently wrote on America's Near Invisible Wounded. Since that piece was published, we hear it on the media, have noticed a very slight uptick in the mentions of the non-fatal casualties. This was NBC reporter Nora O'Donnell at the press conference at the White House last Tuesday.
Mr. President, if I may take you back to May 1st, when you stood on the USS Lincoln under a huge banner that said mission accomplished. At that time, you declared major combat operations were over, but since that time, there have been over 1,000 wounded, many of them amputees who were recovering at Walter Reed.
Lawrence Kaplan joins me now. Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You went to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. Tell me about that experience.
It was actually an incredibly revealing experience, but a particularly upsetting experience as well. I had heard from sources in the military that every night these huge C-17 and C-141 transport planes were landing at Andrews Air Force Base here in Washington from large army hospitals in Germany, and that every night under cover of darkness, ambulances would bring them to Walter Reed. And it was something that just had not been mentioned in any of the press reports that at least I had read. So I arranged to go up to Walter Reed, and after much difficulty, because I don't think the military was keen to have reporters walking around Walter Reed. But at any rate, it was very upsetting because what you're faced with is essentially 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who are missing arms and legs. And Walter Reed, for all of its superb medical care, nonetheless has the feel of a Civil War hospital. You cannot walk down a corridor or through a waiting room or through the lobby without seeing young amputees.
Well, apart from the manifest horror of the scene, obviously dead men tell no tales and wounded men have stories to offer. Did these soldiers, in fact, have stories to tell that you believe were illuminating?
They did. Now we're hearing a lot that there's upwards of 30 attacks a day in Iraq. At the time, Central Command in Iraq wasn't putting a figure for the number of attacks every day. And these soldiers spoke about being under fire routinely, day in and day out. That struck me as somewhat at odds with the coverage. I don't think the impression one gets here, despite the carnage we see every night on TV, is that your average soldier in the field is really under fire on a daily basis. A young soldier from North Dakota told me he was on a river patrol boat looking for Saddam loyalists on the riverbanks and suspicious activity, and he just said every day his boat came under fire from the riverbank, and every day they returned fire. And it really struck me that this is something more than a mopping up operation. And of course, that soldier had lost his arm in one of these attacks.
Now, you mentioned that the Pentagon wasn't exactly leading press tours of Walter Reed. Do you believe that they've actively interfered with the media's coverage of the wounded?
It did strike me as odd that any reporter could easily go to Baltimore Washington International Airport and cover the soldiers coming home on leave, but Andrews is really shut down. Reporters just can't get in there at night to see these wounded coming back. But of course, I think as a policy, and I may be wrong on this, but I think as a policy, this predates the Bush administration. So I don't think there was an active attempt. I think most of it actually is just laziness, if you will, on the part of the media. The army bureaucracy, I don't think, was eager to have me up there, and it took an unusual amount of pushing and prodding to get the interview. But once I did, they were terrific.
There are those who have much more sinister suspicions. TomPaine.com, the liberal website, said that the undercoverage of the wounded was because the biased press, once again, was, kowtowing to the administration. Now, you yourself were writing pro-war stories in the lead-up to the Iraq War. Do you think this is a political story, the undercoverage itself?
You know, I think the media, particularly in the past few weeks, have become sensitive to these accusations coming from the administration and from the conservative press that the media is somehow biased and we're somehow not covering the whole story in Iraq. And I think at some level that's made them reassess what kind of stories they've been doing. And I actually think just watching the network news over the past few nights that I'm seeing evidence of a conscious effort to report roads paved, wells dug, those kinds of stories in Iraq. And I think that is, at some level, a response to the administration's criticism and indeed polls, which have showed that the public thinks the media is biased on Iraq. But on this story, I would certainly understand how some reporters would think this somehow will be construed as piling on. But I don't think reporting on the wounded is piling on at all. As you pointed out, I've written many pro-war columns, and indeed I still support the ongoing operation in Iraq. But I really do think the media has a duty to let the public know what's happening to soldiers on the ground there.
Lawrence, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Lawrence Kaplan is a senior editor at The New Republic and a newly appointed fellow at the Hudson Institute.
Got a problem with something in the paper of record? Make your grievance known.
Thank you for calling the reader comment line at the New York Times. Your message will reach a responsible editor very promptly. If you're calling to comment about news developments or an editorial...
In many cases, that's the most that a troubled reader could hope for in the way of a response from the New York Times. But changes are afoot at the Gray Lady, and soon readers will have a real person to whom they can direct their complaints and whose job it is to respond. This week, the Times named Daniel Okrent, longtime magazine journalist and editor, to the new position of public editor, or ombudsman. For years, the Times has resisted calls to hire an ombudsman, but reversed its stance in response to the main recommendation that emerged from an internal review triggered by the Jason Blair scandal. Daniel Okrent, congratulations.
Thank you.
So, ombudsman, public editor, whatever you want to call it, your job boils down to serving as the official representative of New York Times readers. What does that mean exactly?
Well, what I think it means is that when there's something that troubles a reader for reasons of unfairness, incompleteness, inaccuracy, and maybe that reader who's troubled is me, it's my job to choose which ones are worth investigating, investigate them, and then comment upon them in the pages of the paper.
Have you any oversight over the corrections page?
No. In fact, I may differ with the corrections page. The job, as it's constructed, leaves me outside of the operation of the newspaper. If I'm really going to respond as a reader and in behalf of readers, I shouldn't be part of their operation.
Now, you're in for 18 months, and there's a period at the end of this sentence? You're not going to be
there's
up for renewal?
There's an absolute period at the end of the sentence. It was something that I insisted on and that Bill Keller, the executive editor, was more than happy to agree to. If there were the possibility of a renewal, then could the readers really trust that I'm being impartial, or am I trying to please the people who might extend my contract? So we've already agreed on a salary. We've agreed on a raise. We've agreed on everything that's going to happen to me in those 18 months. And then when they're up, I walk out the door.
You're like a judge.
Yeah. Well, no, I think I can be a little bit straighter than a judge.
Now, according to the Organization of News Ombudsmen, the select, the few, the chosen, only about 36 newspapers nationally have an ombudsman, and most of them are tapped from within the paper. You, on the other hand, never worked for the New York Times. You're an outsider.
Also not a newspaper man. Actually, I did work for the New York Times when I was in college. I was a stringer in Ann Arbor, Michigan 150 years ago. But I think that coming from outside of the newspaper and outside of the newspapering profession gives me the opportunity to ask stupid questions. There are things that you take for granted if you are part of a culture, whether it's the newsroom culture of the Times or the news culture generally, that can give you a hermetic feeling. So coming from outside, yet being a journalist and knowing how to ask questions, I think I may be able to find out things and have a perspective that would be more parallel to the reader's perspective.
It was a rough year for the Times, and I wanted to ask you about that. The creation of a public editor position represents at least part of the paper's coming to terms with the Jason Blair scandal. And I wonder, how does the creation of an ombudsman actually help to head off debacles like the one brought about by Jason Blair?
You know, I don't think it will, frankly. I think that they are so hypersensitized to this, and they've created new systems and new jobs, internal jobs, to prevent this sort of thing from happening again. They don't need me to do that, frankly. What I'm doing, I think, has to do less with the huge visible felony than with the ongoing, perhaps, and unnoticed misdemeanors and sometimes smaller case felonies that inevitably happen in newspapers. Newspapers are fallible institutions.
Alex Jones, the former New York Times media writer and the current director of Harvard's Shorenstein Center, told the Boston Globe that anything critical that you write about the Times now, quote, will be amplified tremendously by the enemies of the Times.
You know, of all the coverage that I've seen of the creation of this job and my appointment, that sentence distressed me more than any other because I think he's absolutely right. It hadn't occurred to me before. I certainly have learned, not just from a lifetime in New York, but since my appointment was announced, the intensity of feeling that people have about the Times is such that it is true. If I find, you know, that there's a pimple on the Times, its enemies will turn it into a virulent case of measles. I think that that's inevitable. But it doesn't mean that one should shrink from saying what one feels.
It doesn't mean that, but we're all human beings. And even if the New York Times editorial offices puts no pressure on you at all, won't you feel some within yourself to perhaps ease up if you think there'll be an echo chamber effect when you criticize the paper?
I hope not. I'm entering this being hopeful about people operating with goodwill. If they don't, there's nothing I can do about that. Certainly, I don't want to damage anybody or any institution carelessly. But they have asked me to be honest. They have asked me to offer my opinion, and I feel compelled to do it.
Have you sought out any old, crusty veteran ombudsman to give you some advice?
I've been in touch with a couple who have generously invited me into the fraternity. And it's a scary business for some of these people. I mean, there was one woman whom I don't know named Joanne Bird, who was the ombudsman at the Washington Post for 2 years. And when she left the job, she said she didn't have a friend left in the building. I go in with very few friends in the building, so maybe it's not that much of a damaging thing for me.
Well, may you remain friendless and pure.
Thank you so much. Oh, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Daniel Okrent is the first public editor of the New York Times. He takes up his new post on December 1st. His new book is called Great Fortune, The Epic of Rockefeller Center.
Coming up, a new State Department glossy says hi to Arab youth, and a Kabul bookseller cries libel.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Amid reports of escalating hostility towards the United States around the Arab world, the State Department continues to mount new offensives in its Hearts and Minds campaign. One of the latest is HI, as in H-I, magazine, which hit news racks across the Middle East in July. Unapologetically youth and lifestyle-oriented, the oversized Arab-language glossy has featured such topics as sandboarding, low-carb diets, and the mainstreaming of Arab music in America. Politics and policy are not on the agenda. But according to Chris Tenzing, editor of the Middle East Report, this decidedly apolitical approach itself makes HI magazine a very political statement.
It's ignoring the 600-pound elephant in the room. It's ignoring the one thing on which there needs to be genuine dialogue between Arabs and Americans. And so to explicitly ignore that in this magazine is a form of condescension. It's saying to Arabs that we're not going to be convinced by anything you have to say in this dialogue anyway, so why should we bother to have the dialogue?
Under the rubric, there's a time and a place for everything. Let's stipulate that this is a sort of soft core propaganda, and the whole object is to win the hearts and minds of young people in the Arab world. Is it not a legitimate path to sort of soften the audience for a harder political message that comes in other venues by just making the Arab world more comfortable with everything else that America is about? Why is that so wrong?
It's not so much that it's wrong. It's just that it's already happening. Arab youth are very exposed to American popular culture and American lifestyles through their own Arabic language media. through the availability of English language satellite TV channels in the Arab world, through the availability of English language publications in the Middle East. High magazine is not completely filling a vacuum. There's one more point, which is that clearly the magazine, by virtue of its price and by virtue of the topics it covers, is oriented at a fairly elite audience in the Arab world. And these are precisely the people who are likely to have relatives who live in the United States or Europe and likely to travel here. And so they have direct exposure to American lifestyles and culture, and they don't need to read about it in a magazine.
Now, clearly, you take issue conceptually with this project, but you also have issues executionally. You just don't think it's a very good magazine. Give me some for instances.
Well, some of the coverage of interactions between Arab and American culture leaves out some very crucial points that Arab audiences are actually likely to know about. One example of that is the article on the influence of Arab music on Western musicians such as Sting and Lenny Kravitz. Lenny Kravitz recorded a song with the Iraqi singer called the Maseher, which was called We Want Peace. This song came out on the verge of the Iraq War. So it was explicitly timed in order to make an anti-war comment. And that context is completely missing from the High article.
So add to the bill of indictment intellectual dishonesty. You've read all four issues.
Yeah.
Have you noticed any evolution of the editorial product? Is it making any attempts to address the criticisms that you're raising?
I have to be fair here. In the first issue, there was an article which profiled a number of Arab students who are studying at U.S. universities and essentially presented their lives as problem-free and completely left out the hugest problem that Arab students who want to study in the United States face today, which is the great difficulty of securing a student visa. And of course, these difficulties have increased dramatically since the September 11th attacks. I think they must have received a lot of questions about that article because in the October issue, they do run a fairly long feature about precisely the process of applying to U.S. universities. And they don't whitewash how difficult that is. And they also do tell a couple of stories of Arab students who threw up their hands in frustration and ultimately decided not to study in the United States.
Well, that sounds suspiciously like journalism.
It does. And I would really hope that the magazine continues to move in that direction. That is ultimately what might distinguish it from the state-run media in the Arab world, which does not engage in much serious investigative journalism. And if that's what High Magazine wants to do, then I would applaud it.
Well, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chris Tenzing is the editor of Middle East Report, and he joined us from Washington, D.C. Richard Creighton is executive editor of High Magazine and founder of The Magazine Group, publisher of High. The Magazine Group client lists includes corporations and large nonprofits like the American Diabetes Association and the Folk Art Museum in New York. But High is Creighton's first government project, and he says that while High is not perfect, it is having an impact.
What we have done is assemble a group of talented Arab journalists from a number of different Middle Eastern countries. We have an editor from Libya, from Syria, from Jordan, from Morocco, from Lebanon. We've created a website, and we are, with every article, posing questions to the Middle East. We're inviting questions, and without any public relations effort and no marketing to date, and with distribution not even in all of the countries where ultimately it will go, we're getting 500,000 hits a month. We're getting 20,000 unique visitors. We're getting responses from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, from Iraq, and the magazine's not yet available in those countries. And so we're encouraged by that and feel that we're trying to start a dialogue, and we have indications that in some ways that's starting.
Tenzing brought up the reference to Lenny Kravitz and how editorially you took it out of context by not referencing the lyrics as explicitly anti-war. Were you playing fast and loose with reality there?
Not at all. I think that while I can respect Tenzing's position, the only thing that he's seeing about it is the political aspect of it. And what we're focused on here is that Lenny Kravitz is collaborating with people on that. And that's one part of this article where the rest of it's talking about Arab music and the influence that it's having on music generally in the United States. And, you know, so there's collaboration, which I think is a good message. And there's the fact that Arab music is permeating our music. And that's what the article is about. And there's nothing wrong with talking about that.
Well, here's an analogy for you. You know, you're familiar with the dynamic of the public schools, which are so cowed by the separation of church and state that they won't even discuss religion or major religious holidays in class for fear of somehow violating the Constitution. Are you so sensitive about veering into political questions that you go overboard and distancing yourself from just reality?
I think there are so many publications here and in the Middle East that focus exclusively on policy, and that has an important place in our lives. But in the process, maybe we overlook a little bit the importance of communicating on a cultural level. Maybe that lays the groundwork for talking about things that might be more controversial or more different.
Because your magazine actually costs money, it's almost by definition appealing to an economic elite. In some sense, are you speaking to the converted, people who already are well acquainted with American culture from many other sources, including Hollywood, and really don't need necessarily to get that update on snowboarding?
Well, you know, first of all,
it's a snarky way to ask the question, wasn't it?
But what's important to keep in mind is that we're trying to talk to 20 to 30 year olds. And so, yes, there is a snowboarding piece. That's a little attention grabber. It's a commercial attempt to get people to pick up the magazine. But then once you get past the snowboarding article, there's an article about water rights and how we deal with conflicts over water rights in the West. And we'll follow a young person who's actually running for political office in the Midwest. And so there's much more to it than that. And this magazine, it ranges in price from 70 cents, I think, to $1.75 or something in that range. And it is priced competitively with hundreds of other magazines that are on newsstands in the Middle East. And in addition to that, there's a website, so it doesn't cost anything to see this magazine.
Well, Richard Creighton, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Richard Creighton is a principal in the Magazine Group in Washington, D.C., and the executive editor of High Magazine.
The Bookseller of Kabul is the best-selling nonfiction book in the history of Norway, where it was first published last fall. Since translated into 17 languages, it's selling briskly everywhere. It's a compellingly intimate peek into the household of a bookseller, a man who saw his books censored or burned under the communists, the Mujahideen, and the Taliban, who was jailed and yet continued to rebuild for love of books and the freedom of thought they represent. When journalist Åsne Seierstad approached the bookseller with her idea for a book, he let her into his home to sleep on mats with his family, share their meals, and chronicle their every move for 4 months. The book just came out in English, and the bookseller has read it. He hates it, and he's suing. Shah Mohammed Rais.
When I read the book, I was shocked. I was terribly shocked. She did not understand the situation. What is going on in Afghanistan? The way she explains the life of our family, it's very insulting way. For instance, she writes that my mother eats too much because she suffered from poverty and starvation, which is not true. It's a defamation of my family. You know, in the way she explains the life of my youngest sister, it's not true. She is very happy. She attended a very proper education. She speaks excellent English. She enjoys life. This book is not true.
Åsne Seierstad's book is less a chronicle of a hero and more a tale of a stern patriarch and his family, particularly his wives and daughters, who live under harsh house rules that break their spirit. She joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
As you know, there's a controversy surrounding the book. It broke when the bookseller finally got to read it when it was translated into English this summer, and he claims that it was a terrifically inaccurate portrait of him, his family, and Afghan culture.
When I wrote the book, I realized after a time, because I was so shocked to see all the things that happened in the family, I realized after some time that he might not like the book when he read it. But he still gave me freedom or liberty to write whatever I like or to see whatever I like. when he finally got to read it, I thought that he would maybe reflect upon it and think, well, in the end, that's how a Western woman sees me, after all. But he did not reflect upon it. He just became crazy. And now when he says this is inaccurate, well, I think he says that because it's maybe too direct when he reads it exactly how it is. For instance, one of the things he criticized me of saying, at some point I say that his sister is like a slave. I use that word only once, but like a slave. And he's saying, well, how can you say she's a slave? I protected her during the Civil War. Now she repays my favors. Well, for us, that is slavery, isn't it? Now she's 20 years old. She was 19 when I was there. And she's sweeping the floor. She's washing. She's cleaning. She's not allowed to go to school. She's not allowed to work. She's repaying the favors of her older brother and giving her shelter.
And as you say, for us, that is slavery. But a lot of critics have said that it is simply incorrect for first world writers to descend on third world countries and write what amounts to a critique of culture.
What should I do then? Should I adopt some third world eyes? I have my eyes. I'm from Norway. Of course, I'm colored by having grown up in the 70s in Norway. My mother is a famous feminist in Norway. My father is a political scientist. I'm grown up in these very liberal surroundings. And of course, for me, there is some essential values that's holy for me. Every person has the same value. Every person should have the same rights to get education, to work, to speak up. Even they can't leave their own house without having permission. For me, I'm describing this. I'm not actually in the book. Those who read the book, they see I'm never judging. I'm never criticizing. I'm just writing whatever I see.
On the other hand, it isn't as if the language is entirely free of judgmental words. For instance, you said that his sister was treated like a slave.
Yeah, that's true.
And those kinds of words describe various characters in the book, especially the submissive females. There's victimization in the language. I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm simply saying that your judgment is clear throughout the book.
That's right. But I've been criticized of you victimizing these women. But they are victims. To my opinion, they are victims. And I think this it's important to write about their lives. And what underlines this is that I got so many phone calls from Afghan women in Norway calling me saying that this is my life.
You said you think there should be values for all people. I guess that flies into the face of people who say that there are different values for different cultures that are equally valid. You just don't feel that way.
No. I'm not a cultural relativist.
It's clear from your introduction, though, that you held the bookseller in far higher esteem at the beginning of the project than you did at the end. Obviously, your perspective changed with the increased intimacy with his family and his way of life, right?
Actually, that's what also proves that my intention were not to, oh, I want to pick out an Afghan family and write how cruel they are. No, when I met the bookseller, because he's still doing, and he did a great job for the culture, for the books, for saving. He was in jail during the communists. He was in jail during the Taliban. He was really doing a great favor to his nation and to the language and to the literature of Afghanistan. So when I met him the first time, I was so happy. What a great man. And when you speak to him, he could even sound like liberal, I don't know, European American saying, oh, we should have equal rights. We need a government with ministers of both women and men. Quite liberal political ideas. And then I moved in, and then I see slowly by slowly how he's just a typical Afghan patriarch, how he treats his family, how he now marries the two wives and they have no rights to speak up, to say whatever they like.
But do you feel that you may have misled your principal subject, however unintentionally, about the project? Wasn't he likely to expect a far more positive family portrait than you ended up writing?
Well, I think he definitely expected something more of him being a hero as he is and as the project started as.
But, I mean, does he have some justification for feeling betrayed, misled?
Well, I think that the alternative is no book. I think it's not possible in a society where the repression of women is so terrible. It's not possible to write, I think, a book of a typical male and he will be pleased with it.
So what do you think a journalist author owes her subject?
Well, if you want to write the truth about harsh regimes, either whether it's inside a family or whether it's on a political national level, your subject will not be pleased with it, and he's not pleased with it, and I don't feel I owe him anything.
This is an international bestseller, and it's been released here in the United States, and it will certainly spark, I think, a renewed dialogue about the treatment of women in Afghanistan and other places in the world. Was this your intention?
The intention was actually just to find out, because I'd been in Afghanistan for 3 months as a war correspondent. I went there right after September 11th, and my days were war, bullets, victims, commanders, all sorts of things like connected to the war. And after 3 months, I realized, yeah, but I know nothing about the country. I know nothing about the culture because it's so close and it's so secret. And that's when I met the bookseller in the bookstore, and I was so fascinated by him and his family. And I said, well, this is the real Afghanistan. That's what happens inside the families. But my intention was actually just to try to understand the Afghan society. It's one thing is to know, yes, this is a brutal society, but to feel it and to live it and to live on the floor with these women, to see them crying, to crying with them, to live their so limited life. My conscience tells me that I cannot not write about it.
Asni Seierstad is the author of The Bookseller of Kabul. Asni, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, zombies and the ghouls who love them.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Here's a riddle for you. What's the difference between Kevin Costner and a zombie movie? Answer, nothing. They're both death at the box office. But in the case of zombie flicks, Tales of the Walking Dead have been filling theater seats for decades.
Peter Jackson, who directed Lord of the Rings, and Sam Raimi, director of Cider House Rules, both did particularly gore-soaked zombie features earlier in their careers. And Trainspotting director Danny Boyle went on to do last summer's zombie hit, 28 Days Later. But the dean of the flesh-eating resurrected is George Romero, whose Night of the Living Dead is a cinema classic and whose sequel, Dawn of the Dead, marks its 25th anniversary this year. That red-letter date prompted OTM senior producer Arun Roth to probe the broader significance of the zombie genre.
It's hard to miss the social commentary in Dawn of the Dead. In the most celebrated scene, hundreds of zombies stumble, blank-eyed, through a suburban shopping mall. Mindless consumerism had the country eating itself.
What are they doing? Why do they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
But zombie movies have had a rich subtext from the very first, White Zombie, released in 1932.
At this time, we were engaged in the occupation of the island of Haiti, which had been a former slave colony of France. Zombies originally are a folkloric creature imported from West Africa.
Peter Dendel is a professor of English at Pennsylvania State University, specializing in folklore and medieval studies. And he's the author of the Zombie Movie Encyclopedia.
I think it's with some irony, then, that the American entertainment industry picks up this icon in the 1930s, because in these movies, in these early movies, it is a sort of white voodoo master or mad scientist who raises the zombies for his own menial ends, to take over the world or just to run his factory or whatever.
The black Haitian zombies in the film literally slave away in a sugar mill run by voodoo master Murder Legendre, played to the hypnotic hilt by a still-vital Bela Lugosi.
They work faithfully. They are not worried about long hours. You could make good use of men like mine on your plantation.
No.
The white zombie of the title is Madeline, an American woman who has come to Haiti with her fiancé to be married at the estate of Beaumont, a man they just met. Beaumont falls in love with Madeline and convinces Legendre to turn her into a zombie so she'll submit to him. Yes, along with an overwrought racial dynamic, there's a huge serving of gender politics.
You've got Bela Lugosi being in possession of a woman's body, for instance, of a living or half-living, moving body, going through the motions of living, getting up in the morning, coming down to the table, but with no glimmer in her eye, with no sense of passion or responsiveness. You've got them being in total control of them, and you've got to scratch your head and wonder, what are they doing when the camera's off?
The black zombie slaves and controlled woman themes appeared throughout early zombie films like I Walked with a Zombie, Voodoo Man, and the aptly named Woman Eater. Racial and sexual anxieties have a timeless appeal, but by the 1950s, the American subconscious had bigger fish to fry.
Since the first revelation of the atom bomb at Hiroshima in 1945, the United States, England, and Russia have been experimenting with more and more increasingly deadly weapons.
In 1959's sneakily subversive Invisible Invaders, nuclear tests convince aliens that Earth is finally worth conquering. They do this by taking possession of human corpses and making them attack the living. Mankind's savior? An anti-nuke peacenik scientist.
You say we should call an immediate end to nuclear experimentation, but you know that's impossible.
Then limit it to experiments for peace.
Dr. Penner, we've been over all this before.
The zombies of Invisible Invaders seem almost entirely middle-aged white men in suits and ties.
What is a zombie but a conformist? What is a zombie but someone who has to go through the motions, maybe with some tiny instinctual primal awareness underneath it all, that he's not fully experiencing what it means to be an individual, to be human?
But lest you think that the zombie is a creature of the left, film critic David Edelstein points out, the depersonalized zombie was also a fine metaphor for what was creepy about communism.
I mean, any kind of collective delusion, communism as well. I mean, you can look at Don Siegel's Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the Phil Kaufman remake as zombie movies. These are movies in which people have their individuality deadened and they become part of the collective.
The reanimated corpses may have represented soulless Eisenhower conformists, or maybe they were soulless communists. But one thing seems clear. The real enemy was us. Whether it's zombies and invisible invaders or pod people from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, characters are repeatedly confronted with friends and family who now see them as prey. And in 1968, just when it must have seemed like America really was turning on itself, in a year of assassinations, violent protests, and race riots, George Romero came out with Night of the Living Dead. David Edelstein says the film is a powerful metaphor for the meltdown of the American family.
The American family imploding from within. It's no accident that brothers turn incestuously on sisters. And that little daughters kill their own mommies.
In the film, a group of survivors barricade themselves against a zombie onslaught in an abandoned farmhouse. Our protagonist is Ben, the only black man in the bunch. He's also the only one who's not petty, rendered stupid by fear, or just plain stupid to begin with. Because of his level-headedness, Ben is the only one to survive the night. But the next morning, he's shot by a band of roving rednecks deputized to exterminate the zombie menace.
All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
Peter Dendel.
A lot of the images in Night of the Living Dead respond specifically to some of these social tensions. The reliance on authority sort of falling apart. The police force is a veritable sort of militia of rednecks.
Keep those dogs back off of those things.
In Romero's story, every person who died became a zombie, rising again to feed on the flesh of the living. The decades after Night of the Living Dead saw an explosion of movies in this vein, and Romero-esque zombies appeared in hundreds of features, even spawning cottage industries in Italy and Spain. And since 1968, Romero's zombie children have taken off in countless symbolic directions.
Zombies are blanks. You can project anything you want on them.
David Edelstein.
You can make them Southern KKK hicks and they can become mindless reactionaries, or you can give them vests and peace signs and they become mindless counterculture drug casualties. You can give them plague and then they become carriers of sexual diseases. Romero's innovation in Night of the Living Dead was to make them cannibals or vampires, to make them actual carriers of plague. And this is something that's followed through on in 28 Days Later.
28 Days Later features a zombie plague created by the release of a deadly or undeadly virus. As in most of the post-Romero films, the main characters tend to meet their end not because of the zombies, but because they lose their head. Or their humanity.
Easy, Tiger. You know what I got picking a fight with me, son?
Sergeant Farrell! Mitchell, first action on.
We secured a perimeter, sir.
Then get to it.
The true horror, it turns out, isn't the infected, but the people who put their own welfare over the rights of others. It's not the flesh-gouging zombie that we have to worry about in those movies. It's the soul-gouging zombie within.
When 28 Days Later came out last summer, critics raved about its broader themes, which included sexism and man's tendency to fascism and fear of a self-induced apocalypse. It was dubbed the Thinking Man's Zombie Movie, a distinction only true if you haven't been paying attention for the past 70 years. For On the Media, I'm Arun Roth.
Up until the mid-70s, late-night TV was a haven for zombies. Dozens of markets aired locally produced weekly fright shows, each featuring their own uniquely crafted horror host. Performers with names like Jeepers Creepers, Sir Graves Ghastly, and Dr. Shockall became local legends. OTM's Rex Doan takes a look back on TV's old horror show hosts and says, "Fangs for the memories."
As a child growing up in Northeast Ohio, Michael Weldon became addicted to monster movies. By his own admission, this consuming passion eventually rendered him unfit for conventional employment.
Yes. Since early childhood, I was really obsessed by horror movies. You know, my schoolwork suffered, it's true, but I became a film fanatic.
In fact, Weldon became one of the leading authorities on fringe films. Psychotronic, Weldon's movie magazine, along with the Psychotronic Encyclopedia of Film, are considered to be indispensable by movie mavens with a taste for the unusual. For Weldon and his many readers, entry into the weird world of monster movies began under the tutelage of their local shock theater program.
For the most part, the TV horror movie host phenomena started in the late 50s. Reason that happened was that packages of old horror movies were released to local stations all over the country, and they decided to create horror movie hosts locally. And Zachary, by far, was the most famous and most successful of the late 50s horror hosts.
Jonas, we turn off the radio. I can't stand that music there.
Horror hosts like Zachary in New York and the dozens of others working in smaller local markets not only invigorated late-night television, they single-handedly reintroduced important and influential films like Dracula, Frankenstein, and The Invisible Man to a whole new generation. But as Michael Weldon is quick to note, there was never a shortage of trash.
Even the original shock theater package that some people like to remember as all classic films was only partially classic films. They were padded with really mediocre ones and ones that had nothing to do with horror.
We've got some bad movies here at Channel 7, but that one's one of the worst.
Part of the reason why most of the horror movie hosts got into making fun of the movies, because a certain percentage of them really were bad.
I wish I didn't have to say it, but we have a film this evening called Horror Island. It's on an island, and it's pretty horrible.
The cheap prop Zach used during his intermission breaks only added to the mood.
I think for hearts, we used a big hunk of liver, and we'd have it jumping up and down on the table in front of us. And my brains, of course, were cauliflower, and the nerves were spaghetti.
You also had a giant amoeba, didn't you?
Giant amoeba, my Lord, I almost forgot that. Yes, I was having dinner in a diner one night. And we ordered Jell-O, And the guy drags this big tray of Jell-O out and slices it up and hands it to us. And I'm saying, my Lord, why don't we try that? So I made a bucket of Jell-O and took it into the studio, and it looked horrible. It really looked horrible.
Yes, my dear, I hear. Yes. I'm just sewing up the old amoeba here. It'll heal properly, and who knows, maybe something will come of it.
With his popularity continually on the rise, Zachary even made a run at the Oval Office.
Yeah, the slogan was, put a vampire in the White House just for fun.
Despite his failed presidential bid, Zachary did hit the top 10 in 1958 with his hit record, Dinner with Drac.
A dinner was served for three at Dracula's house by the sea. The Wolfman was there, the monster was there, and the only normal person was me.
In 1960, some New Orleans musicians cut a record in honor of their own local horror host, Morgus the Magnificent.
Saturday night, when I go for my date, my baby and I just sit and wait for
Morgus the Magnificent.
Morgus Presents first aired in 1959 and ran on and off for 12 years, including a brief comeback in 1987. Eager to return again to television, Morgus still awaits for the big call. Can I speak to Dr. Morgus, please?
This is Dr. Morgus. By the way, who is this?
This is Rex Doane. I'm calling with the National Public Radio show On the Media.
Oh, that's right. Well, they told me you might be calling here. By the way, where are you located?
We're in New York.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'd love to go up there. One day I'll be invited to one of the big science symposiums. they'll be knowing more about me very shortly, I'm sure.
Good evening. Welcome to Morgus Presents.
Like a reality show. In fact, we were the first to do reality shows. We started in 1959, would you believe?
But reality was something that Cleveland's fabled horror host Goulardi never seemed to really grasp.
Here we are. And this is, I thought you saw this a couple of times. That's a Ghoul Katir. G-O-U. L-E-Y. Why? Because you're sick. That's why.
With raunchy R&B records blasting in the background, exploding fireworks, and his own cryptic commentary, Goulardi achieved a level of anarchic reverie rarely seen on television. Michael Weldon.
Goulardi was using the sort of beatnik sick humor that was around at the time, which was very negative. Sometimes funny, sometimes in bad taste.
Goulardi plays nothing but poker. See, what you do in poker, you get a girl, and you poke her.
To the chagrin of his teenage viewers, and to the delight of the local PTA, Goulardi left Cleveland in 1966 to embark on a long and profitable voiceover career in Los Angeles. Eventually, syndicated sitcoms, late-night talk shows, music video programs, and infomercials began to compete for the after-hours TV audience. By the 1980s, horror show hosts became an endangered species, and, as Michael Weldon notes, everything else about local television began to change, too.
Today, we're missing out on the sense of community that went along with local television programming. Every local station throughout the country had their own talk shows and kiddie shows and movie shows and quiz shows, and I think the loss of these shows was a bigger deal than people realize.
Happily, there is some hope on the TV horror host front, but you may have to travel to find it.
Cleveland currently has three rival horror show hosts, all deriving from the Goulardi show. So it seems like Cleveland's television is in a time warp, which I think is wonderful.
Okay. Goulardi says come back. We'll see you next week. Be good. Stay sick.
For On the Media, in New York, I'm Rex Doane.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.